Listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 1st, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As always, thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: more than any other generation, young adults are tightening their year-end budgets and shelling out less for gifts, survey data show. Stocks and cryptocurrencies linked to Trump are in a deep trough, leaving some of the president's biggest supporters with steep losses. Defense tech companies and artificial intelligence startups are lining up to sell the U.S. military tools for a different kind of war. Western companies that found easy profits in China in years gone by are adapting to a new reality of fiercer competition in that market. Zootopia 2 dominated the Thanksgiving weekend domestic box office and demonstrated that the right Hollywood movie can still make big money in China. U.S. shipping companies, which are generally required to hire Americans, say they aren't attracting enough sailors, despite high pay and substantial perks, that is raising national security concerns. Copper thieves have wreaked havoc in the Los Angeles area, stealing and reselling wires that transmit electrical signals for phone and internet lines. Cyber criminals are using online freight marketplaces to infiltrate logistics company computer systems to identify and steal high-value cargo. Difficulty gauging AI startups' earnings is frustrating venture capitalists who say they are working overtime to judge what is real before they make an investment decision. Now for the key articles under the Worldwide section. U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators said a meeting on ending the war with Russia, which included talks on possible elections, land swaps, and security guarantees, was productive. And top U.S. envoys will head to Moscow on Monday for further discussions. Congress launched inquiries, and lawmakers from both parties raised the possibility of war crimes after a report that the U.S. targeted survivors of a strike on an alleged drug boat. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu officially requested a pardon in his corruption trial, an unusual move over an issue that has divided the country. Northwestern University agreed to pay the Trump administration $75 million to settle complaints of alleged discrimination at the university and to restore federal research funding. Demonstrators confronted immigration enforcement officers in New York City, preventing masked federal agents from leaving a parking lot. Hondurans voted in a presidential election that was muddied after Trump endorsed one candidate and promised to pardon a former Honduran president serving a prison sentence in the U.S. for turning his country into a narco state. the FDA will upend its approach to immunizations for respiratory illnesses, including flu vaccines, according to an email to staff from the agency's vaccine division director. Died Tom Stoppard, 88, playwright and screenwriter. The picture on today's front page takes place in a meeting room with a very long table where a dozen or so men are standing. And the caption reads, "We keep on knocking at the door and coming up with ideas." From left is Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And then there's a picture of Rustem Umerov leading the Ukrainian delegation and the head of Ukraine's Security Council. And on the right, the Ukrainian First Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Kristala at the talks in Florida on Sunday. And the article, U.S. and Ukraine Discuss Thorny Issues, Productive Talks Center on Land Swaps, Guarantees, Trump Aides Set Russia Visit, by Deborah Acosta and Robbie Gramer. Hallandale Beach, Florida. U.S. and Ukrainian negotiators said Sunday's meeting on ending the war with Russia, which included talks on possible elections, land swaps, and security guarantees, was productive. And top U.S. envoys will head to Moscow on Monday for further discussions. Seated alongside each other at the negotiating table for more than 4 hours, Secretary of State Marco Rubio, U.S. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, and President Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner made progress, said Rubio, who added that the negotiations are complex. The talks covered possible timetables for new elections in Ukraine and the prospect of land swaps between Russia and Ukraine, a senior U.S. official said. Other key issues that remain unresolved include the nature of U.S. and Western security guarantees for Ukraine and whether the Kremlin will continue to demand international recognition for the territories it has seized from Ukraine since it's launched its full-scale invasion in 2022. We don't just want to end the war, we also want to help Ukraine be safe forever, so never again will they face another invasion, Rubio said after the meeting. There's more work to be done. This is delicate. It's complicated. There are a lot of moving parts, and obviously there's another party involved here that'll have to be a part of the equation. Kushner and Witkoff will fly to Russia on Monday to continue the discussions, the U.S. official said. Trump said that Witkoff will likely meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Ukrainian delegation was led by Rustem Umerov, the Secretary of National Security and Defense Council of Ukraine, in place of Andriy Yermak, one of Ukraine's top officials who has resigned amid a corruption scandal. Our objective is a prosperous, strong Ukraine, said Umerov, standing next to Rubio outside the negotiating room. This meeting was productive and successful, he said, without offering specifics. Neither took questions. Trump has renewed his drive to end the war after months of failed negotiations and escalating Russian attacks on Ukrainian energy infrastructure and civilian targets. A day before the U.S. and Ukrainian delegations met in Florida, Russia bombarded Ukraine with a nearly 10-hour air assault, with hundreds of missiles and drones that struck residential buildings and energy infrastructure. When Umerov met with Witkoff and Kushner in Miami in October to review the initial proposed 28-point plan, he bluntly said the deal favored Russia over Ukraine. At the negotiating table on Sunday inside Witkoff's Shell Bay Golf Club in South Florida, Umerov voiced appreciation for the Trump administration's efforts. The U.S. is hearing us. U.S. is supporting us. U.S. is walking beside us, he said. Over 3 years into the war, it is unclear if Putin is willing to make concessions that would get both sides to agree to peace terms. At a press conference last week, the Russian leader said he was ready for serious discussions to end the war, but reiterated demands that Ukraine must withdraw its troops from Donetsk and Luhansk in eastern Ukraine's Donbass region, including areas of the region not controlled by Russia. When Ukrainian troops leave the territories they hold, then the fighting will stop, Putin said. If they don't, then we'll achieve that through military means. Ukraine has previously refused to accede to those demands, countering that any withdrawal from the region will leave it vulnerable to further Russian attacks. Unlike in Russia, where Putin wields total control, the diplomatic and legal hurdles on the Ukrainian side are significantly more complicated. Any change to Ukraine's borders would require a nationwide referendum. Ukraine's wartime powers also freeze presidential and parliamentary elections. The prospect of holding new elections is a politically fraught issue in Ukraine amid the war and could lead to interference campaigns from Russia. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is under increased political pressure at home against the backdrop of the peace talks after a corruption scandal that pushed Yermak to resign. Russia dangles business ties to U.S. at Europe's expense. Kremlin pitched White House on investments in industry to end war. By Drew Henshaw, Benoit Falcon, Rebecca Ballhaus, Thomas Grove, and Joe Parkinson. Three powerful businessmen, two Americans and a Russian, hunched over a laptop in Miami Beach, ostensibly to draw up a plan to end Russia's long and deadly war with Ukraine. But the full scope of their project went much further. According to people familiar with the talks, they were privately charting a path to bring Russia's $2 trillion economy in from the cold, with American businesses first in line to beat European competitors to the dividends. At his waterfront estate, billionaire developer turned special envoy Steve Witkoff was hosting Kirill Dmitriev, head of Russia's Sovereign Wealth Fund, and Vladimir Putin's hand-picked negotiator, who had largely shaped the document they were revising on the screen. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, had arrived from his nearby home on an island known as the Billionaire Bunker. Dmitriev was pushing a plan for U.S. companies to tap the roughly $300 billion of Russian central bank assets frozen in Europe for U.S.-Russian investment projects and a U.S.-led reconstruction of Ukraine. U.S. and Russian companies would join to exploit the vast mineral wealth in the Arctic. There were no limits to what two longtime adversaries could achieve, Dmitriev had argued. their rival space industries, which raced one another during the Cold War, could even pursue a joint mission to Mars with Elon Musk's SpaceX. For the Kremlin, the Miami talks were the culmination of a strategy hatched before Trump's inauguration to bypass the traditional U.S. national security apparatus and convince the administration to view Russia not as a military threat, but as a land of bountiful opportunity, according to Western security officials. By dangling multi-billion dollar rare earth and energy deals, Moscow could reshape the economic map of Europe while driving a wedge between America and its traditional allies. Russia has so many vast resources, vast expanses of land, Witkoff told the Wall Street Journal, describing at length his hopes that Russia, Ukraine, and America would all become business partners. If we do all that, and everybody's prospering, and they're all a part of it, and there's upside for everybody, that's going to naturally be a bulwark against future conflicts there, because everybody's thriving. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Retailers Feel a Chill from Gen Z Shoppers by Jennifer Williams. Economic worries aren't putting much of a dent in consumers' holiday shopping plans, with one glaring exception, Gen Z shoppers. More than any other generation, young adults are tightening their year-end spending budgets and shelling out less for gifts, survey data show. That is a problem for retailers and brands that look to Generation Z, a group that runs from teens to late 20-somethings, to drive shopping trends and boost spending steadily as they earn bigger paychecks. This year, more are taking the tack of 25-year-old Sonia Ikebani, who has warned loved ones that she is spending less this season. The sales account executive is paying rent for the first time, which together with student loan repayments eats up $2,400 each month. Those extra costs come on top of higher price tags for groceries and other essentials. My bank account is certainly not where it once was, the Long Islander said. She told family members in October, so it will be, you know, a lighter Christmas for me. Gen Z shoppers recently said they expected to cut holiday spending by an average of 34%, sharply more than any other age group, according to a Deloitte survey of more than 4,200 U.S. adults. Generation X consumers, those between 45 and 60, and in their peak earning years, were the only cohort to say they plan to spend more. A separate PricewaterhouseCoopers survey found that in addition to spending less on gifts, Gen Zers are pulling back on travel, dining out, and clothes shopping. Drug War Bolsters Defense Startups by Heather Somerville and Vera Bergengruen. The U.S. military has turned its attention southward, and the defense industry is lining up to sell it the tools for a different kind of war. Defense tech companies and artificial intelligence startups have found a vital new market in President Trump's rapidly escalating drug war. Weapons and AI platforms that were designed for a future conflict with China or struggled to prove themselves on the Ukrainian battlefield have found a niche in the administration's tech-enabled crackdown on drug trafficking. Trump on Saturday said the airspace surrounding Venezuela should be considered closed, ratcheting up tensions with Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro, and offering yet another sign that he is considering striking targets on land in the campaign. Venezuela's government condemned Trump's push, calling it a colonialist threat. Drone and imaging companies are assisting the U.S. Coast Guard and Navy with interdiction operations in the Caribbean. AI companies from Silicon Valley to Dubai are pitching platforms that promise to map the hidden networks of fentanyl traffickers. On the southern U.S. border, a counter-drone system developed in Ukraine is being repurposed to deflect incursions from Mexico. Netanyahu seeks pardon in line with Trump's call, by Anat Pellid. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has officially requested a pardon in his corruption trial, an unusual move over an issue that has divided the country. The request comes after President Trump called several times for Netanyahu to be pardoned. The Israeli Prime Minister was indicted in 2019 for bribery, fraud, and breach of trust, charges he denies. He has been testifying as a defendant in his trial since last December, while Israel has been at war and hasn't been convicted. Netanyahu made his request in a letter to Israeli President Isaac Herzog without acknowledging any wrongdoing, arguing that a pardon would be in the public interest. According to a copy of the letter released by Herzog's office, Honduras votes in close election after Trump wades in, by Jose de Cordoba and Juan Carlos Rivera, San Pedro Sula, Honduras. Hondurans cast ballots in a presidential election thrown into disarray in its final days after President Trump endorsed one candidate and promised to pardon a former Honduran president serving a prison sentence in the U.S. for turning the Central American nation into a narco state. The election was expected to be close even before Trump injected more uncertainty. Aside from picking a president, more than 6 million voters will elect 128 legislators and fill hundreds of other posts. This is the second time in recent months that Trump has inserted himself into a Latin American election. In October, he conditioned an economic rescue package for Argentina to President Javier Milei's party's victory in midterm elections. Argentines, fearing an economic implosion, voted overwhelmingly for the country's ruling party. The outcome isn't clear in Honduras, an impoverished nation that relies heavily on U.S.-bound migrants. We don't like Trump because he has affected thousands of households who depend on remittances due to his mass deportations, said Jose Antonio Rodriguez, a pensioner who voted for leftist candidate Rixis Macata of the ruling Liberal Party. Honduras has suffered greatly from drug trafficking, and now Trump wants to send us a drug lord, said the 75-year-old Rodriguez. Most polls put Macata behind Salvador Nasralla, a 72-year-old sports journalist and media personality who briefly served as vice president in the administration of outgoing president Xiomara Castro. Trump last week urged Hondurans to elect a third candidate, Nestory Tito Esfura, the candidate of the Conservative National Party. He associated Makata with communists and said Nasrallah's candidacy would split the anti-communist vote. Endorsing S. Fuhrer on Wednesday, Trump conditioned U.S. aid on his winning. If he doesn't win, the United States will not be throwing good money, he said. Tito and I can work together to fight the narco-communist and provide the necessary aid to the Honduran people. FDA to upend vaccine policies by Liz Essley White. The Food and Drug Administration will upend its approach to immunizations for respiratory illnesses, including flu vaccines, according to an email to staff from the agency's vaccine division director, Dr. Vinay Prasad. Prasad said in the email, which was reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, that the pivot comes after the FDA found 10 children had died because of the COVID-19 vaccine, though he didn't outline evidence or details of the deaths. The proposed revisions are likely to reshape how vaccines are developed and raise concerns in the medical community about what data will be used to back those changes. The change is the latest in a series of shifts on vaccine policy from the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees the FDA. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a longtime vaccine skeptic, in May, said the U.S. would drop recommendations for pregnant women and children to get coronavirus shots. A vaccine panel he reconstituted voted in September to nix affirmative recommendations for adults to receive COVID shots, instead leaving it to individual decision-making between doctors and patients. This is a profound revelation. For the first time, the U.S. FDA will acknowledge that COVID-19 vaccines have killed American children, Prasad wrote in the email, which at several points criticized the Biden administration for supporting vaccine mandates. The truth is, we do not know if we saved lives on balance. U.S. faces shortage of commercial sailors. Good pay and perks aren't enough to fill jobs, raising concern over national security. By Daniel Michaels. Kings Point, New York. Some of America's best starting salaries are at sea, and they aren't luring enough workers. Straight out of college, graduates from the country's maritime academies can earn more than $200,000 as a commercial sailor with free food and private accommodations. Commercial sailors travel the world. Coffee breaks come with an ocean view. At night, the sky explodes with stars. Despite the pay and perks, maritime jobs go begging, and it is raising national security concerns. America is already short of commercial seafarers for a cargo fleet President Trump wants to see grow. Very little cargo currently moves on American-flagged ships, partly because of staffing. U.S. shipping companies, which are generally required to hire Americans, say they are starved of crews. The shortage is getting attention. An executive order from Trump and proposed bipartisan legislation aimed to resurrect America's maritime industry across shipbuilding, ship ownership, and shipboard staffing. The Pentagon depends on commercial sailors and private ocean carriers to move its equipment. The U.S. employs an estimated 10,000 commercial sailors, a number that has fallen sharply as America outsourced much of its shipping demands to China and other countries. For the Navy, which operates only a small number of cargo ships and relies on commercial carriers and mariners for most of its needs, the shortfall could be crippling. The Navy last year mothballed 17 supply ships because there weren't enough commercial crews to run them. In a conflict, the U.S. would likely struggle to position, reinforce, and resupply its overseas forces. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, the October EV sales crash. As subsidies expire, buyers stay away from electric showrooms. It's rough these days in electric vehicle showrooms, as buyers are staying away now that the $7,500 per vehicle tax credit has ended. This is good for taxpayers, and it shows the danger of relying on government subsidies for your business model. Cox Automotive reports that dealers sold 74,835 new electric vehicles in the U.S. in October, a 30.3% year-over-year decrease. October marked a sharp reversal for electric vehicle EV market as the expiration of the federal EV tax credit cooled demand after 3 months of accelerated sales, said Stephanie Valdez-Streedy, Director of Industry Insights for Cox. The tax credit expired on September 30th, which led to a surge of EV buying to get the federal subsidy while it lasted. The sales drop will further pinch the margins for U.S. EV manufacturers, most of whom were losing money on electric cars even when sales were buoyant. GM, Ford, and Stellantis are adjusting their EV production to account for the sales plunge. EV profitability remains a distant dream for nearly every automaker, Cox said in October. Many Americans love their electric cars or trucks, and perhaps EVs can hold their own in the post-subsidy marketplace. But that's where their future should be determined, not in the back rooms of Congress or the White House. One problem with the subsidies, supercharged by the Biden administration, is that they created a false market for EVs that exceeded genuine consumer demand. The GOP Congress helped taxpayers by eliminating the EV credit, saving tens of billions of dollars. Buy that Tesla or Ford F-150 Lightning if you want, but the American way is to do it on your own dime. From the opinion pages, Biden's IRA is harming cancer patients. Since the law's passage, companies have halted at least 55 research programs and given up 26 medicines. By Thomas J. Phillipson. Democrats' 2022 Inflation Reduction Act wasn't designed to kill cancer innovation, but new evidence reveals that's what it's doing. The law strongly discourages drug companies from performing the follow-on research after initial discoveries that accounts for a disproportionate share of progress in the fight against cancer. The crux of the problem is that the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, imposes price caps that shorten the effective life of a patent and applies those price controls even to later approved uses. 13 years after FDA approval, biologics, which are typically infused or injected, become subject to price controls. For small molecular drugs, typically pills or tablets, the window is only 9 years. The clock starts at a drug's first approval, leaving a follow-on or alternative use, approved years later, an insufficient period to make up the cost of research. 2 weeks ago, a study I conducted with colleagues at the University of Chicago appeared in Health Affairs. It reveals how much these provisions harm cancer research. In reviewing every Food and Drug Administration approved cancer drug between 2000 and 2024, we found a large part of innovation in cancer treatment takes place after a therapy is first approved. About 42% of the 184 cancer therapies that were initially approved during that period had follow-on approvals involving new uses or indications for an existing drug, such as treating additional cancer types or being used earlier in the disease when treatment outcomes tend to be better. This cumulative progress through follow-on discoveries is a big driver of new cancer treatments. The largest drug class, making up about 35% of the overall FDA pipeline. Cancer drugs are generally first tested in patients with late-stage disease, after which the drug is studied for use in earlier stages of that cancer and for new uses, including treating other cancers. Our study found that 60% of follow-on drugs treated earlier stages than the initial drugs. This is important because treating earlier stages is often more successful than when a cancer has spread more. But that cumulative progress depends on incentives for sustained research well after the first FDA approval, often years of additional trials and investments, and those incentives were killed by the IRA. As our study details, on average, the first follow-on approval for the drugs we studied came after 3 years after the original. The second follow-on typically comes 1.5 years after that. For the average small molecule, that leaves only 4.5 years to earn returns on investments made to expand a drug's approval into earlier stage cancers or other indications before the IRA price cap kicks in. And these are averages. Many follow-on approvals take significantly longer, leaving even less time on the market to justify the expense and uncertainty of continued research. Examples illustrate this clear risk. Enzalutamide, a prostate cancer drug, was first approved in 2012 for late-stage patients. Almost 6 years later, it was approved in earlier stage patients. Letrozole, a breast cancer drug, followed a similar path, moving from stage 4 cancer treatment to stage 2 over more than a decade. Under the IRA, those follow-on approvals likely wouldn't have been economical. The IRA will severely hurt future cancer patients, particularly because the law is so punitive toward small molecule drugs. Many experts see these as especially important for the future of cancer treatment. Pills often have fewer side effects than biologics, are easier to take, and can be engineered to hit precise targets inside cells. yet the IRA price cap kicks in 4 years earlier for pills than it does for biologics, even though the latter are typically doctor-administered and thereby more expensive. The result has been exactly what you'd expect and what I warned about in these pages prior to the IRA's launch. Since its passage, companies have halted at least 55 research programs and abandoned 26 medicines. That's orders of magnitude larger than the Congressional Budget Office prediction that the IRA would result in only one less drug coming to market in the decade after it became law. Even my larger estimate of the damage to innovation may have underpredicted the law's destructive force. The IRA is short-sighted. Each innovative medicine that's never developed is one less drug that ultimately becomes a cheap generic. About 93% of all U.S. prescriptions are filled with generics after innovators have been rewarded for making the generic launch feasible. The ongoing damage the IRA is doing to medical innovation reaches beyond follow-on research. Early-stage biotech investment in small molecule development dropped a whopping 70% between the law's introduction and May 2024, according to one study. And new cancer program starts for small molecules fell 43% in 2024 compared with the pre-IRA average. This means fewer drugs entering the pipeline and fewer opportunities to expand existing therapies through follow-on research. My colleagues and my new evidence suggest that fully repealing the IRA's price controls would greatly benefit patients. But until that happens, giving both biologics and pills 13 years before price controls begin would minimize the damage. The bipartisan EPIC Act would eliminate this pill penalty of the IRA, enabling countless follow-on uses that might not otherwise be discovered. Policymakers need to ensure the IRA doesn't kill off the cumulative research that could make cancer easier to endure and more affordable to treat. More broadly, lawmakers must understand that for cancer and other diseases, medical progress doesn't end at FDA approval. Many times, that's only where it begins. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The college students who can't do elementary math. Kids in elementary school learn, or are supposed to learn, how to add fractions and round numbers. But many students at the University of California, San Diego, a top public university ranked sixth nationally by the U.S. News and World Report, can't do either, according to a new analysis from the university. Read and weep for the future of America. Roughly 1 in 8 freshmen lack rudimentary high school math skills, defined as geometry, algebra, and algebra 2. It gets worse. Students who had been placed in a remedial high school math class in 2023 had roughly fifth grade level abilities. Only 39% could correctly round the number 374,518 to the nearest hundred, a third grade skill. Because so many incoming students were numerically illiterate, the university added a remedial class for middle and elementary school math. Remarkably, among students placed into that math class, 94% had completed an advanced math class in high school. Example, pre-calculus, calculus, or statistics, and received an average A- in their math classes. Is this an indictment of A, the University of California's admissions, B, public K-12 schools, C, U.S. News and World Report's college rankings, or D, all of the above? If you chose D, you're correct. Start with A. The UC Board of Regents in 2020 scrapped standardized tests as an admissions requirement under the guise of promoting equity. The likely real reason blacks and Hispanics score lower on average on the SAT. Requiring applicants to submit standardized test scores could also make it easier for critics to prove the university is providing racial preferences, which were prohibited by a 1996 voter referendum. The math proficiency analysis suggests it may be doing so on the sly. Amid a push to boost diversity and overall enrollment, and thus rake in more government student aid, UC San Diego admitted increasing numbers of unqualified applicants from low-income high schools. In order to holistically admit a diverse and representative class, we need to admit students who may be at a higher risk of not succeeding, the report says. This has done a grave disservice to ill-prepared students who take longer to complete degrees and thus accrue more debt and drop out of more rigorous majors. Few, if any, students who take remedial math successfully complete an engineering degree, the report notes. The university's admissions place a heavy emphasis on GPAs, but these don't reliably reflect student preparation because grades are inflated. Some students may also cheat their way to high grades. Smartphones and AI have made it easier to do so. At the same time, scores on AP tests have become a less dependable marker of merit. That's because the College Board has made the exams easier to pass, to encourage more students to take them, and thus rake in more money from testing fees. The share of students passing AP exams has soared over the last two decades, including for calculus AB, 6.3 percentage points, English language and composition, 17.9, chemistry, 21.9, and U.S. history, 23.3. Call it vanity grading. Mediocre students now graduate with top GPAs and AP scores, which makes parents feel better about their kids' public schools and eases political pressure for education reform. On to answer B. The report says students have been underserved by their prior schooling. No kidding. Only 22% of 12th graders scored proficient in math on the National Assessment of Educational Progress, NAEP, last year, the lowest on record. One UC San Diego remedial math tutor observed that some teachers would teach life skills in high school math class, just using calculators, the internet, and prescribed formulas. Classes didn't teach mathematical thinking. One problem is union contracts protect lousy and lazy teachers from being fired and prevent talented, hardworking ones from being rewarded with higher pay. Meanwhile, some of the profession's best teachers, highly capable women who entered the profession when their sex had fewer career options, have been retiring. Many of the replacements are lacking. Teacher credential programs typically require only a C-plus average in undergrad. With the pervasive grade inflation in colleges, many young teachers may themselves have only fifth grade math skills. Answer C. Many parents mistakenly consider the U.S. News and World Report's rankings a proxy of a college's prestige. But the rankings don't reflect the caliber of students a college admits, nor graduate outcomes that matter. The rankings don't factor in student standardized test scores for colleges like the UCs that don't require them. Graduation and retention rates make up by far the biggest weight in the rankings, but that may encourage colleges to inflate grades to ensure that unqualified applicants that they admit still graduate. Graduate employment outcomes account for only 5% of the rankings weight. To its credit, the UC San Diego report recommends reinstating a standardized testing admission requirement. This may help, but that Titanic may have sailed. After many colleges made standardized tests optional, the College Board last year dumbed down the SAT in an effort to encourage more students to take it. The test now takes 2 hours instead of 3, and students get more time to complete each question. Gone too are long reading passages that might strain TikTok attention spans. Analogies were eliminated in 2005 after academics claimed they were culturally biased. The sum of all this is a tragedy of the education commons. Institutions acting in their own interest are debasing America's pool of young human capital. Heaven help us. California digs a deep budget hole. Even as revenues soar, the state faces large looming shortfalls. California Governor Gavin Newsom is fond of exultant press releases, and there's no doubt Silicon Valley is prospering amid the AI boom. But here's something you won't hear him talk about. The state is facing huge budget deficits despite an ebullient stock market and capital gains rush. That was the warning last week from the State Legislative Analysis Office, LAO. The nonpartisan policy advisor projects an $18 billion budget gap in the coming fiscal year and $35 billion shortfalls after that. This may be optimistic since it assumes no recession or severe market correction in the next several years. What are the odds of that? The fundamental problem, LAO says, is spending growth continuing to outstrip revenue growth. And that's some feat, given that revenue during the first 4 months of this year is running about $12 billion, about 20% higher than last year during the same period, thanks largely to taxes on realizations from capital gains and stock options. These strong income tax collections are being driven by enthusiasm around AI, which has pushed the stock market to record highs and boosted compensation among the state's tech workers, the analyst says. Many workers at the state's tech firms and chip makers like NVIDIA receive compensation in stock, whose value has soared with their company's share price. Alas, the rest of the state's workers and economy aren't doing as well. California businesses have pared back hiring, resulting in no payroll job growth in the state so far this year, the LAO notes. California consumers similarly are limiting spending, with sales of taxable goods flat over the last year. Democrats who run the state aren't showing the same frugality. The LAO says state spending on retiree health care, pensions, employee compensation, and prisons are exceeding earlier projections. State spending, as a share of personal income, has increased by 20% over the last decade, and the state's number of workers per capita has climbed 22%. Sacramento has grown its government workforce, even though most businesses are doing little hiring. Democrats may try to blame the GOP tax bills, Medicaid, and food stamp reforms, but their estimated contribution to the state's deficit is de minimis, about $1.3 billion. This is nothing compared to the $120 billion the feds are spending this year on California's Medicaid program, which is $24 billion more than 2 years ago. The LAO also warns that California's deficits will be harder to fix going forward because Democrats have used up budget gimmicks to close past shortfalls. Enter the Service Employees International Union, the United Healthcare Workers West, which has launched a referendum campaign for next November to impose a 5% wealth tax on billionaires. The union claims this will be a one-time tax to raise money for Medicaid, though its measure allows the Democratic legislature to increase the rate and extend the tax. Mr. Newsom, in the past, has said he opposes a state wealth tax. But will he buck his union friends as he prepares to run for president in 2028? Don't bet your 401k on it. That was from the editorial page. The Pepper and Salt cartoon shows a mother at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and behind her is her young son. And she says, "Yes, I can help you with that as soon as I finish doing everything else." You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 1st, 2025 issue of the Wall Street Journal. We read from the Wall Street Journal every Monday through Thursday at 11 p.m. Your reader has been Corrine. Thank you for listening.